Venezia, aspettando punta della dogana. Il quarto ospite della serie promossa da Palazzo Grassi in collaborazione con lo IUAV e l'Università Ca' Foscari è l'americano Richard Serra.
When I was a student, I'd been drawing since I was 4 years old, and basically my mother used to introduce me as Richard the artist, and so that was something I could always do. When my brother and father were taking the car apart, I would draw the parts. So the idea of some hand-eye coordination in relationship to having an alternative language, namely drawing or marking on a piece of paper, was something I always did. I came from a very poor family. We couldn't afford paper, so the butcher would give my mother rolls of paper, which I would use as unfurl and draw on after every night after dinner. So my mother would introduce me constantly, even when I was very, very young, as Richard the artist. So then when I went to graduate school, I took as many courses as I could in art history and painting, but I thought that if I really wanted to get educated, I ought to major in English literature. And I happened to transfer from the University of California to the University of Santa Barbara, and Aldous Huxley was there, Reinhold Niebuhr was there, Margaret Mead was there, Christopher Isherwood was there. Everybody wanted to be there because it was a new university, only 2,000 people. It was tutorial, and I transferred there and majored in English literature. I sent Yale 12 drawings, and with no hope of even getting into the graduate school. And because I had a high grade point in English literature, they accepted me and said, "You'll have to get your undergraduate degree in art history here before entering the graduate program." So I went to Yale and simultaneously did art history and their graduate course together, and they accepted me basically because I could draw. They accepted me on my grade point and because I could draw. And that was a big break in my life. But if you want to know why I chose one over the other, the only way for me to proceed with English literature, I would have had to learn German to get a doctorate, and I didn't want to learn German. I have no ear for it.
Questo è Richard Serra, che spiega cosa lo abbia spinto a studiare letteratura inglese prima di dedicarsi alla storia dell'arte e al disegno, e del perché tra i due campi abbia poi deciso di abbracciare la seconda e non la prima. Con Lynn Cook parlerà invece di spazi museali, di matericità, forma ed evoluzione formale, di spazio e tempo, di soggettività, curve, angoli retti e architettura.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. There's a lot to take in what Angela said, but I want to begin by going back to the question of museums, particularly since there will be a new museum here next year for the Pinault collection. And this question takes something of a preamble in order to get to it. So let me begin by saying, in 1991, Richard, you were involved in a discussion with the British architect and architectural theorist Alan Colquhoun, myself and Mark Francis, which was looking at histories and typologies of museums of modern art. And the discussion began by thinking about Schinkel, who was the first to design a museum of modern art, and the premise of that was that the museum was a treasure house, it was a storehouse for great existing works. And then, as the discussion evolved, we began to think about new typologies that had evolved in the post-Second World War period and came up with two others. One was the museum as laboratory. An example of this might be the Centre Pompidou, which was designed to be as flexible and open a space as possible that could be constantly reconverted or reworked as artists needed in relation to the kinds of work and the procedures and processes they were involved with. The other one was the converted warehouse or factory. And this idea of industrial buildings from an industrial era, like Deer in Chelsea and many others, the model for which really came out of artist practices in downtown New York in the 60s and 70s, as artists worked in lofts, they made work that responded to those spaces. And you could say, in a sense, that museums took this up. And from that came this idea of converted industrial spaces being ideal spaces for contemporary art. Do you think a new typology has evolved since then? And if so, what might it be?
I think the recent typology with escalators and floors stacked on top of each other mimics the department store. And I think the further typology that we see, particularly in Los Angeles now, starts to model itself after the shopping mall. And I suspect that the way commodification has gone will end up in Kmart. That's not being cynical. I mean, I think that's where it's at.
Maybe some of the roots to this, that we're talking about a building that was designed by Piano, which is like a big open, somewhat open structure that's supported by columns and has, that's structurally supported by columns and just has perimeter walls.
I think one of the things that's happened is that architects have taken their cue from the social economic zeitgeist of any period where people are making work. So when Panza began collecting, the form that he was collecting was reinstated in terms of the loft space. The problem with that is that when these works were initially made in loft spaces in the 60s and 70s, they had a certain vitality and intensity in regards to the place which they were made. If you think of Flavin, Judd, Andre, and so forth, myself, Nauman, whomever, once those works were then put in white, pure cubicles like shoeboxes, you were able to take that entire package and transport it and put it in various museums. So what had been gained was the inclusion in the museum. The deficit, on the other hand, was they became packageable and transportable. I think with museums opening with several spaces and lots of different venues in terms of coffee shops and libraries and whatsoever, particularly if the New Modern Museum, they seem to reflect the department store mentality. I also think that people have figured out that people who go to museums don't like to go up an escalator, so there's probably going to be an emphasis on bringing the buildings back down to a ground level. Once you bring them back down to a ground level, particularly in Los Angeles and other places, they start to characterize themselves like malls, where you wander from one space to the other, and then there are contingencies that serve the gallery goer or museum visitor's interest apart from looking at art. And I think, again, what's driving that is the market. The market responds to the work, the architects respond to the market, and finally the architecture that we have will serve the needs of the generation that's producing the work. I don't say that in a cynical way that I'm not implicated in it. I'm totally implicated in it. I'm just trying to answer the question about how typologies evolve and looking at the realities that we're faced with.
If you were asked to be a consultant by an institution that wanted to build a museum, where would you start?
I think I would start by asking a host of different artists who have yet to emerge and where unexpected you thought they were going and listen to what their desires are, rather than imposing the limitations of a social economic system that wants to confine art to codify it in a way that makes it presentable to the collecting class and the class that deals with the formation of the museums. I think what you have right now are hosts of people, particularly in the United States, who fund museums, who collect work, and then they want their collections in the museums, and so museums collect collectors. And basically what happens is that museums are collecting collectors who collect things that fit into spaces, and those spaces end up fitting into museums. So the circuitry doesn't get broken. It takes young artists with different kinds of aspirations to break open that situation and satisfy their needs. So if the question is, how would I start? I'd probably start by gathering a lot of younger artists together with a lot of younger architects and have them discuss what they think the problematic is that exists today.
When you and your generation were working in the 60s, you had a much, well, maybe not skeptical, but more ambivalent attitude to museums. And a lot of the work that you did and a lot of the work that your peers did actually took place outside galleries and museums. Now we seem to be turning 180 degrees, where artists are working primarily for galleries and museums. Do you think this is a problem?
Well, I think when I started working in New York, there was a collective of people that were involved with making things in relation to time and process, and it didn't matter whether you were a painter, a sculptor, a filmmaker, a photographer, an actor, a freak, it didn't matter who you were. As long as you could come together and work for each other and be each other's audience, and you could survive on part-time jobs, that kept the kind of collective and the energy and intensity of that collective going. I think now a lot of work is market-driven, and the situation of a youthful collective certainly doesn't exist in New York, but it may exist in other places. It may be in Berlin, it may be in Tokyo, it may be in Hong Kong, I don't know. I think every generation defines for itself its needs, and every generation probably gets what it deserves.
You once described galleries and museums as, quote, testing grounds for ideas, suggesting that the work you were doing outside, whether in urban spaces or landscape spaces, took those ideas and they evolved in a site-related way. Do you still feel that?
Well, I think if you're dealing with flat floor and in an enclosure, you have to deal with the parameters that exist. So you have to declare or divide the space, and you have to deal with the volume of the space, and you try to convert that space into one that doesn't have an architectural function, but one that serves the needs of your particular concerns, whether they're volumetric or whether they're dispersal or whether they're interactive. I've been able to go from the inside to the outside and vary my concerns given elevation using a similar problematic, even though the context changes. But what I try to do is to allow the context to a great degree decide on, or help me decide on, the size, shape, mass, weight, placement, circulation, whatsoever. So I take my cues from the situation that's given. On the other hand, you can't wait for commissions or galleries or museums or whomever to serve it up. So I have a need to invent. So I've been building lots of works recently that are contained, you need a flat floor, but are pretty much contained within the internal dialogue that ensues when you walk into and through and around them. And those pieces, for about 6 or 7 years, were developing out of curvilinear pieces, either torques or cylinders or cones or spirals.
You've just put Clara Clara back up in Paris. This is a piece that's in the Tuileries and that was made and first shown there in the 80s.
25 years ago.
So looking back on it, do you see it differently? Has the context changed? Has the social circumstances changed?
That piece for me was a kind of fluke in that when I proposed the piece, I proposed it for the space interior to the Centre Pompidou when it first opened. Dominique Bozeau, who was the director at the time, and Alfred Pacman was the curator, asked me to build a piece interior to the museum, and they had a large pit there. And I designed 220-foot curves, one inverted, so that they leaned in the same direction. If you think of a lampshade turned upside down, going one way and then the other. And because of weight load conditions, the piece couldn't be placed there, and Dominique Bozeau's idea to place it at the entrance of the Tuileries, facing the obelisk and on line with the main axis of the Tuileries Garden and the Champs-Élysées, and it happens that you have two Baroque elevations moving up on both sides of the main entrance, and these pieces have two curves juxtaposed to each other with a 6-foot space in between. So the idea of curve answering curve seemed to make a lot of sense, and I put the piece up 25 years ago, and I thought I was in over my head when it went up, and it couldn't have been, for me, a better related piece to a site, even though I didn't intend it to be there. 25 years later, we put it up 2 days ago, and other than thinking that it was faster than I remembered, by faster I mean that I've been working with plates 14, 16 feet high. I haven't been working much 12-foot high plates, and a 12-foot high plate over 120-foot expanse has a different acceleration in terms of how your body relates to it, in terms of how you move, how you pass by it. And much of what I do has to do with your relation to space as you move through it. And what I didn't recall was the speed of this piece and the way that it collected the space. So even though the piece was 25 years old, for me, putting it back up, it seemed as fresh as having done it 2 days ago. And some pieces you don't want to go back and revisit because you'd rather not claim them because it's like some thing you'd wish you hadn't done. This piece is completely fulfilling for me, and I'm happy that it's up, and it's going to be in conjunction with a piece we're doing for the Grand Palais. And the Grand Palais is an enormous space. It's probably almost 800 feet long, and it has no walls. It's transparency. If you people know it from Paris, it's a big glass crystal palace. And we're putting up 5 plates that align the central axis on both sides that are impaled into the ground. And there's 75 ton each, 60 feet high, 12 feet wide. And that starts about a week from now. I have to make a trip to Spain and Switzerland and Bilbao first. But on the way, when we come back, we're going to start that installation. And that's something I'm really looking forward to because I haven't been dealing with flat planes, although I've built 2 vertical pieces of a similar module, somewhat less in scale, one in Germany called the Brahmin and one in the University of California Medical Center in San Francisco. So I have some idea of what those pieces do in relation to holding their own in juxtaposition to each other over a great distance. The piece in San Francisco, the plates are 120 feet apart, and they seem to resonate. So placing pieces opposite a central axis 100 feet apart, even though there are 5 of them equally spaced, gives me reason to believe that they'll hold the space, although there aren't any guarantees. I mean, we haven't put this piece up before, so I don't know quite what to expect. I could formally tell you some of the things perceptually I think it'll do, but that has nothing to do with the experience of the piece when it goes up.
In the interview with Hal Foster 3 or 4 years ago, you were talking about the ellipses, these pieces that you've been making since the late 90s, which have a kind of curvature that hadn't existed in built form before. And if I may quote, you said, industrial space was largely defined by the frame and the grid. Contemporary space is much looser, smoother, faster. It's more about movement than framing. It's more related to skin, surface, and extension. Scenography is replacing tectonics. I'm interested in the skin returning you to the space of the void, to the volume. And you've talked about this in relation to some of the, and differentiated it from, some of the experiences we are seeing in architecture too. For example, the architecture of Frank Gehry perhaps, but which also existed a little earlier with Corbusier, and there are precedents in the past. Do you think this space that, at least in the talked ellipses, is disorienting and very hard to measure or remember? This seems to be a kind of space that we really haven't known before as viewers.
Well, I think that if you're interested in image, then you probably wouldn't be interested in what occurs in relation to walking into, through, and around the pieces that I've been making for over 20 years now. My pieces don't coalesce into image, and they tend not to center themselves. They tend to be decentered, and they tend to deal with disequilibrium and discontinuities, and they tend to deal with anticipation and memory. So after you walk these pieces or walk into several of them, or particularly in and out of Bilbao, you don't retain an image. And basically, I'm involved not with the objectness of an image or not with the recall of an image. I think what happened in the beginning of the century, and it was implied by Picasso's guitar, was, if you think about it, it's a construction that opens the space and allows you to figuratively, with your gaze, move into that space. It's a construction, so to speak. That pretty much bracketed casting and modeling as being conventional. Very few people picked up on it except the Russians, Lisitsky, Malevich, Tatlin, so forth. And they tried to formulate it into an urban setting with a larger reference to some social, political, revolutionary idea of the possibilities of art in urban places or architecture in urban spaces. That pretty much died out after the Russian Revolution and wasn't picked up again until probably the implication of the minimalist in the generation that I came along with, namely Smithson, Naaman, England, Richard Long, Eva Hess, myself, amongst others, where what happened was the discrete object gave away to the openness of the field, where time became one of the criteria that manifested the experience, your relation to moving in through space over time. Once the work gets off the pedestal and it enters into the behavioral space of your own time, then your own subjectivity becomes an issue. And I don't think there's anything more subjective in terms of individuating our differences other than time. The time that you were born probably individuates you from the person sitting next to you. What you know about history, what you knew before, what context you were born into, what memories you have, how you anticipate, all of those things become highly personal in relationship to how you understand space and place in relation to moving through it. Those subtexts, time, movement in relation to space, decentering, disequilibrium, what's on your right, what's on your left, how you're implicated in moving through the space, are basically the subtext of the issues that I've been dealing with for as long as I've been making work. Having said that, I don't think there's going to be any end to people putting works, figurative works, on pedestals and casting and modeling. I think there's probably a great market need for that, and it may even inspire some great works. Who knows? I mean, Picasso, after his guitar, ended up going back to modeling and casting. People have always returned to well-worn sequences and found ways to extend them. You know, you can think of Bonnard as being a later-day impressionist, and still he painted some great paintings. So it doesn't mean that sequences are closed just because other venues are open. I think the way I would analyze the 20th century is that the two big figures were probably Malevich and Duchamp. And right now, as far as I can assess what's going on, we're kind of in a post-pop, post-surrealism heyday. It's kind of like post-pop surrealism that's basically dealing with figuration. The flip side of that would be abstraction. And in terms of the movements of the 20th century, from Dada to surrealism to abstract expressionism to pop art to minimalism to post-minimalism, I would say that abstraction is probably really the movement that defined the 20th century in terms of invention, albeit right now it's probably the weak sister. I've sided my lot with Malevich over Duchamp, but I realize that we're in a Duchampian heyday right now.
Talking about space-time, a lot of cultural theorists talk about a paradigm shift, and you might relate it to notions of space-time or a movement out of the industrial era with the grid and the frame to other kinds of space which are less determinate and not just in the actual world but in the virtual world, and that the spaces that we look at in computers, the spaces that we look at virtually, seem to begin to have analogs in the real world.
I think virtual reality is real insofar that it's virtual. The problem I have is that it's not actual. And I think the reality of actuality is very different than the reality of virtuality. And I'm interested in the manifestations of unmediated actuality. And I think right now, most art that's being done is pre-mediaized. You come to it already knowing what the canned image was. So it's a reaffirmation of images that have already been reproduced. So it's a reconfiguration or a re-representation of that which exists or art which has existed before. So it's a kind of a meta-language that art is involved with now in terms of virtual reality and re-representation. If you're interested in actuality, then you're interested in what physically attains in relationship to the time that you experience the work, and you yourself become the subject of that time. So the shift between object and subject becomes crucial. What's the content no longer resides in the frame or in the depiction of the figuration, but the content resides in your experience of walking into and through and around. So the work of art is mainly a vehicle for you yourself to become the subject matter of your own experience, whether or not you know anything about art.
Recently came across an essay by Walker Percy, which is an American novelist, and also he's a writer on literature. And he was writing in the late 50s, and it seemed to me very prescient. He's talking about responses to works of art, but also to landmarks and monuments. And one of the examples he's using is the Grand Canyon, but he's also thinking, as I said, about artworks. And he says the problem for anyone today coming to encounter one of these is that we already have, it's filtered in our imaginations, it's already mediated, we're preconditioned through our knowledge of the world, that we can't approach it afresh, and that it's very difficult to have an immediate, unfiltered experience. And he says also, there are two parts to it. And the second problem he identifies is that most people who encounter a work of art feel that they somehow are unable to trust their own perceptions, responses, and that they cede the sovereignty of themselves as spectators to specialists. And that this idea that one needs to have recourse to art historians, critics, and others who are insiders or speak the language as a way of attaining knowledge that will ground your own experience seems to him invidious. And as I was thinking about this, it seemed to me prescient of the 60s because I think at that moment, artists go in two ways. On the one hand, there are those who, as you were arguing, making huge efforts to try and have the work encountered in an unmediated way and without reference to specialists or without reference to their own thinking as guide or as author or as spokesperson. And then on the others, I'd say there are artists like Robert Smithson, for whom all experience seemed to have been mediated and who embraced that in a very voracious way and spent a great deal of time creating discursive contexts around his work through his writing, through the kind of non-sites, which could be lectures, they could be pieces in galleries referring to works that were situated in landscape, they could be film, they could be otherwise. And the most extreme opposite to Smithson, I suppose I would see as Walter de Maria, who has never given an interview, won't say anything about his work, won't give writers the opportunity to reproduce the work, and does everything to try and have the work appear as if it could not, you know, as if it were possible to get rid of mediation.
I think there's two problems there. I think that Smithson's use of media doesn't mean that the spiral jetty is dealing with mediaization in terms of reconfiguring a representation that existed. There wasn't any spiral out there that started with a straight line and then coiled back on itself. I don't think you can find it in pottery. I don't think you can find it in iconography. You can find spirals, but you don't find ones going out into the water like a jetty that turns back on themselves. I think that Smithson had a great need in terms of having his work consumed to deal with available media. So he dealt with available media as an extension of the work to bring that work to an audience. I suspect that of all the people who know Spiral Jetty, less than 0.01% or less than that even have ever seen it, have ever been there, or even know where it is, or would know how to get there. But everybody has an image of it. You have an image of it because it was shot from a helicopter, like a flat plane, like a drawing on a canvas, or like a drawing on a piece of paper, so it's easy to retain in terms of its gestalt. Most land art deals with that kind of re-representation, in that its graphicness has been available to the media and the pieces have been consumed in terms of their iconography, in terms of mediaization. But Smithson himself, I don't think, and I helped him stake out the spiral jetty, so I have some way of knowing that, went through any process whereby he was trying to re-represent something that already existed. Because when I first went out to see Bob, the piece was not a spiral, it started like a big question mark, And it was only after he almost had a nervous breakdown that he figured that the question mark in terms of Ubuwa and Alfred Jarry wasn't going to work. And he thought that he had to reconfigure it. And we together, with help of some other people, laid it out in terms of a spiral. And then I went off to Japan. But Bob was very interested in the multiple manifestations, how work could then enter into the culture without having to actually physically view the piece in its situation. I think one of his great strengths was the idea of the non-site. You do something in some places, and then you bring it back in terms of documentation. Having said that, he sponsored probably a whole generation of people who documented every time they took a step outside their building, or every time a passerby. There was an enormous decade of documentation of anything from scratching your head to falling downstairs, which got to be a little tedious. But if you return to what Smithson really laid out in terms of doing something here and bringing it back to the museum in relationship to either bins with rocks in them or maps or crystals, it makes sense in terms of cohering between one place and the other, of conjoining those two places. And in that sense, I think he remains vital to probably younger artists today, along with Marcel Brothers in another way. Both of them seem to set up a dialectic between sight and non-sight, whereby information could be collected to allow the viewer to extend themselves into both places.
He published articles in art magazines and Harper's Bazaar. He made a film that was shown at film festivals and so forth. So it seemed to me as time evolved, he was looking through for other channels and was recognizing that these other channels would be the ways in which, as you say, most people would get to know the Spiral Jetty, because most people would not trek out to the Great Salt Lake even if the piece was out of the water. And I think this is what Walker Percy's talking about, not the kind of postmodernist reworking a given or existing form, but the fact that our experience of many things that we value or would take as important and meaningful is already conditioned in some way.
Yeah, I think that you enter into mediaization the moment you're born, but it's a matter of degree to which you want to deal with the immediacy of your experience as such in a given place, in a given time. I think language has a lot to do with interfering in our relationship to direct experience. Simple things like metaphor will allow you to go to a place and say, this is like that. Well, this isn't like that. This is like this. And I'm more concerned with the immediacy of the actuality of the site, the place, in the moment, than this being like that or bringing back something else that is a surrogate for that. So in terms of what I find interesting in art is the intensity of the work as it exists in its place, and the effort that went into the manifestation of that intensity, whether it's physical labor or thought. On the other hand, physical effort without mental thought is probably labor unredeemed. So there has to be a conjoining of the manifestation of matter with time, place, circumstance, sight. And if I've talked about matter, what I would say is that matter, any material at all, imposes its own form on form. When you talk about mediaization, you're not talking about the site, you're not talking about the physicality of the site, you're talking about something that's been reduced to an analog, a flat piece of paper or a screen that allows you to partake in the reality of that reality, but it's not the reality of the situation that exists as a reality. And I'm more interested in the actual reality of the experience in the place, at the time, where it was made, if it still exists, where you can thereby have an experience of it in and of itself. And one of the reasons I go back to look at works of art, I was just in the Orangerie, and I can still go back to, and this is where I think what Percy is a little flip, is that I can go back and look at a given Cézanne and see that the horizon of the table starts here and the apple's rolling forward here and the other horizon's over here and the apple's moving to the side over here and the apple seems to have the weight of a boulder, and that there's a displacement in terms of what I'm looking at in terms of the structure that this person has brought forward to allow me to perceive space in a way I hadn't thought was possible before. Now, I think that's how art evolves. It evolves through the history of structure, not through the history of mediaization or through the history of decor or ornament. And I'm more interested in invention and experience of structure than I am in the latter.
You're part of a generation that spent, well, it was unusual in that you and Smithson, Judd, and others wrote about your work, were interviewed, have spent a good deal of time forming the discursive context in which your work is received, conveying ideas, setting out some of the precepts around and through which your work is interpreted. How does that fit with what you've just said?
Basically, it comes down to what you know and what you don't know. One of the reasons I got into building curves was I stood up a curve one day and realized I didn't know anything about it. I mean, if you think about a curve, any manifestation of a curve, if you're standing at the edge of a curve, the thickness of a curve, what's on one side is a concavity. If you put your finger like this, what's on the other side is a convexity. You can take in the concavity and understand the whole breadth of the volume of the space, but you don't understand the convexity because you have to walk it to know it. Now, that seems like a very simplistic idea. Oh, everybody knows what a curve is. Well, no one knows what a curve is until you actually experience the walking of the curve. The fact of the matter is, the latter part of the 20th century was pretty much devoid of curves. I mean, we were pretty much in a rectilinear structure. It was the tyranny of the right angle. I think we're entering into a century where the curve will predominate and the corner will evaporate.
But you've invested a lot of time and energy in talking to art historians, to critics, to journalists. We're sitting here talking to a lot of people whom I believe are students. You told the story about risking having your work taken out of a museum in Bilbao by going to talk in the art school, even though that had negative impact for you. You do believe in communication. You do obviously spend a lot of time talking to us, all of us, about what you're thinking, about where the work is coming from, what some of its key ideas are. And that doesn't mean we can't experience it directly ourselves, but you are shaping a discursive context because all works exist in discursive contexts. If you're interested in the intuitive and the pre-verbal as the experience of the work, how does that gel with the fact that you equally are engaging and giving a lot of energy into
propaganda. Purely that. I mean, basically, I would like people to engage themselves in the space and place and time of my work. And I think how you do what you do kind of confers meaningfulness on what you've done. I can't drag people in to see my work. But if I can tell you that that's what my concerns are, you may think, oh, that person has some idea that's different than prevailing ideas. It seems to be singular in terms of its antithetical nature to the second half of the century, given the onslaught of Duchamp. That might be interesting to witness and experience. And basically, what I'm trying to do through words is engage you to possibly experience the work in place. So if I say it's propaganda, it's purely propaganda, which differs from advertisement.